Are you tired? Are you frequently in a state of fatigue? It might surprise you to learn that your cellular health begins to decline as early as 25 years of age. As you age, your cell membranes start to become like Swiss cheese. This cellular damage is the primary cause of biological aging. It could be the root of your fatigue. But there's a breakthrough supplement that's scientifically proven to repair and renew your body's cells. NT-Factor Lipids. NT-Factor lipids are identical to the phospholipids found in your cellular membranes. NT-Factor is the only solution proven and published in medical journals to repair those dead spots in the membranes. If you're older, it can give you back the vitality, focus, and cognitive function of people half your age. And if you're young, this is the tool to optimize your energy production. I've been using NT-Factor for years and prescribe it for my patients. Learn more about the NT-Factor line of nutritional formulas at your favorite health food store or online retailer, or to order direct, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Some people think that what this country needs is a metabolic revolution. We're going to find out what that might entail with today's guest. He's Dr. Stephen Hussey. He is the possessor of a master's in science, and he's also a chiropractor and functional medicine practitioner. He also has a master's of science, master's in human nutrition from the University of Western States. And he has an interesting story, a personal transformation that he'll share with you, which has also fueled his desire to get the word out about metabolic medicine and encouraging us to undertake a metabolic revolution. Now, a unique event transpired in Washington at the end of 2024. He's going to tell you all about it and how you can partake in it, because some of the most illustrious speakers in the world of metabolic medicine had an opportunity to share their wisdom. Doctors like Dr. Asim Malhotra, Dr. Robert Lustig, Nina Teicholz, Dr. Georgia Ead, many of whom I've interviewed here on Intelligent Medicine, as well as Eric Westman, an acolyte of Dr. Robert Atkins, and one of my favorite guests, the nutritionally oriented psychiatrist, Dr. Chris Palmer. So a lot of wisdom can be obtained by going to metabolicrevolution.org. And today's guest, Dr. Stephen Hussey, is going to tell us all about it. So Dr. Hussey, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you embarked on this journey, because you now have a practice. You're well known. You address audiences and educate people and health professionals. But what prompted you to take on this journey?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people in this space, it's direct experience. With some of us, it's direct experience with patients and seeing what we're doing is not working. Others, it's more personal. And for me, it's quite personal. So from a very young age, I had a lot of, you could say, inflammatory conditions. I had allergies. I had chronic hives all over my body. I used to break out in hives. I had irritable bowel syndrome, asthma, lots of different inflammatory things. And ultimately ended up with type 1 diabetes, diagnosed at the age of 9.
Wow.
And my parents and I were kind of dependent on Western medicine to help us manage those conditions, as, you know, one does. That was the key word, though, is always manage them. No real explanation of why are they there and what can we do to make them go away. And so it wasn't really until college when I started, you know, changing my lifestyle, and I majored in health and wellness in college. And I learned that I could change the way I live my life and change what I ate and all these different things. And I'm happy to say that most of those conditions went away, aside from the type 1 diabetes. It's kind of collateral damage from that inflammation.
That's virtually impossible to reverse, unlike type 2 diabetes, where often weight loss and exercise can have you revert to normalcy. But once you've lost those pancreatic islet cells, they're done. But you can mitigate the consequences of the type 1 diabetes. You can reduce your insulin requirements and so on. But I imagine that your care when you were growing up was quite fragmented. How many different doctors and specialists did you have to see to handle all the different faulty organ systems of your body?
Sure, yeah. I mean, my main was a pediatric endocrinologist who I'd go to every 3 months. But yeah, there was the PCP, there was the ophthalmologist, lots of different practitioners, kind of
allergist, I imagine, yeah.
Yeah, monitoring me to make sure these things didn't get worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of different types of practitioners. But, you know, they're all looking at, you know, specific systems, one system, when in reality, it all works as one functioning unit. And likely different issues you see in different systems are all one underlying issue that's creating all those symptoms. So, but it was kind of a runaround. And again, no real answers as to why this was happening, just reaction to what was happening and try and suppress the symptoms.
So can you contrast a conventional medicine approach to these problems to a functional medicine approach to these problems? Because you undertook the arduous training in functional medicine, what I'm very familiar with, which involves courses and certifications and deep learning that goes beyond your studies as a master's nutrition candidate, and even in chiropractic school, where fortunately there is some emphasis on nutrition, unlike a conventional medical school.
Yeah. You know, I tend to look at the body now as just perceiving its environment and responding to it, basically. So if it's responding in a bad way, like we're getting a disease process, whether it's some symptom or a full-blown diagnosable disease, it's basically a response of your body to its environment. So we have to change the environment. And that environment could be many different things, right? So in conventional medicine, they just focus on that symptom and they say, okay, you're having this symptom or you have this disease, we're going to address that. We're going to give you this medication, or we're going to give you this procedure or whatever to treat that symptom or disease. Whereas in more functional medicine, holistic medicine, or for me, just studying what it takes for life to exist, you know, and maintaining that, it's more of, okay, let's change the signals the body's getting so that it expresses itself in a more healthy way. And those signals could be diet, they could be light, they could be stress and relationships. They could be electromagnetic fields. It could be all kinds of things that all these, like we have to redefine, I think, diet as not just what you eat, but everything your body is exposed to on a daily basis, mm-hmm. because it's always responding to those. And we have
it's sometimes referred to as the exposome. In other words, your exposure, the whole universe of your exposures, not just your food, but, you know, the water that you drink and how much you drink and so on and so on. So ultimately, how did you turn the ship around? What was the secret sauce? I mean, obviously, it was an all-of-the-above approach, but explain the process by which you tamed many of these disorders.
Yeah, I'd say at first, it was mainly diet and exercise. I'd always been active playing sports as a kid, so it was easy to maintain activity. I liked to play sports in the voice and things like that. So that was easy. The diet stuff kind of evolved over the years. It was started out with just making more healthier decisions. And then I've always been able to, you know, stick with things and I'm kind of strict about that. So I could always stick to a certain diet. And so that diet evolved over the years and it got, I would say, healthier and healthier based on the more I learned. But over the years, I've also learned that it's not just diet and exercise that will create health. And sometimes I think there are things that are even more important. I think our light environment is probably one of the most important things to pay attention to. And the, you know, the light and circadian rhythm and disrupted circadian rhythm is actually heavily, heavily associated with poor metabolic health, which is something that's sometimes overlooked. It's not just the processed food and poor diet. But I've also looked into a lot of like stress and past traumas and how that can negatively affect health, non-native electromagnetic fields, which are things that are not compatible with our physiology. So lots of different toxin exposures, many different things that can affect our health negatively. Yeah.
When it comes to diet, one of the common denominators of most of the speakers that are on the speakers roster for metabolicrevolution.org, they're low-carb acolytes. I know Nina Teicholz for many years, perhaps, you know, two or three decades. Robert Lustig is a pediatrician who's a big proponent of low-carb dieting for aptly called metabolic syndrome. And we're talking about metabolic revolution. A lot of these people have a low-carb diet that addresses metabolic syndrome. Dr. Georgia Ead, low-carb, keto, even carnivore. Dr. Eric Westman, an accolade of Dr. Atkins, who's famous for the low-carb Atkins diet. Chris Palmer, advocating a keto diet for mental health optimization. And so, is that something that you've espoused and you've garnered benefits from?
Definitely, yeah. Especially as a type 1 diabetic. It makes type 1 diabetes much easier to control when I'm very low carbohydrate. But generally, we see, like, and there's a lot of literature coming out now that being on a lower carbohydrate diet helps you attain metabolic health, you know, which metabolic health to me just means that you are very metabolically flexible. You can easily go back and forth from burning fatty acids, primarily in ketones and glucose, and you can do that easily. Where someone with poor metabolic health gets stuck in this glucose burning mode and their body almost downregulates mechanisms to burning those fatty acids. And so I would argue that it's not so much that a low-carb diet is therapeutic. It's just that it's the diet that humans are really designed to thrive on. You know, there would have been times in our natural environment where we came across some carbohydrates with fruit and honey and things like that. But for the most part, carbohydrates were much less readily available back in the day when we lived in the woods and lived off the land and stuff than they are today. Whereas you can get carbohydrate foods every day of the week, and you can get high carbohydrate foods every day of the week. So it's not like it's this extreme thing that we're having to do to mitigate disease. It's just that if we're eating the processed food American diet, the modern day diet, we get disease, and we go back to a more evolutionary consistent diet of lower carbohydrate, and we see a lot of disease processes go away.
But as a type 1 diabetic, you know, the traditional diabetes training is that you have to have a certain amount of carbohydrates to offset your insulin. They sort of teach you to make sure you have adequate, you know, pasta or bread portions to make sure that you don't become hypoglycemic. You're supposed to carry around a packet of sugar in case your sugar bottoms out. There's so much teaching around making sure you have, as a type 1 diabetic, making sure you have adequate carbohydrates. And I'm old enough to remember, in fact, I went to medical school with Dr. Richard Bernstein, who you may well be familiar with. He's the proponent of a very low carbohydrate diet for type 1 diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes. He himself is a diabetic. I believe he's still alive and thriving. He's even a little older than I am, because he was the oldest student in my medical school class. And so have you noticed any change in your insulin requirements or your ability to keep your hemoglobin A1C relatively under control with relative avoidance of carbohydrates? Is it possible to go very low carb when you're type 1 diabetic?
Definitely. And more stable blood sugars. That's the most important thing for me, is that I'm not worried about those low blood sugars necessarily or overdoing it, you know, because things stay pretty stable. But insulin requirements have definitely dropped. And I've been on a low carb diet, like very low carb for probably 5 or 6 years now, pretty strict. So insulin requirements are very low, but it's across the board with type 1 diabetics, you know, depending on which type of insulin they use and how, you know, how receptive they are to it. Definitely decreased the amount significantly. And it's like, you know, I'm trying to be a pancreas in a sense, you know, trying to predict how much insulin I'm going to need to inject to cover a meal. And so if I take, or if I eat foods that require less insulin to do that, or that don't create extreme spikes in blood sugar like glucose can, then it's much easier to predict what I'm going to need and counter correct whenever things go along if it's a much slower rise in glucose. It makes no sense to me that the dietary guidelines for type 1 diabetic and type 2 diabetes is that you need, like, I think it's like 50 to 60% of your calories from carbohydrates. Yep. And I remember as a kid being handed a book by the diabetes educators that basically listed every single fast food, there was a fast food item on a menu that there was, and the amount of carbohydrates that it had in it, because that's all they cared about you that you did. Yeah. You just count the carbohydrates and you give yourself insulin for it. Yeah. And that was it. And it was just, there was no focus on the quality of the food or the fact that these carbohydrate foods, like, oh yeah, you can eat those, just give yourself more insulin. The fact that it's way easier to control things, which you don't do that, which was totally backwards, but I didn't know that at the time. I was just a kid.
Yeah. In the history of diabetes, the only relatively prolonged survival of type 1 diabetic kids, and their lives were shortened because, no question, it was a very devastating condition. But the only way prior to the invention of insulin and introduction around the 1920s was the very low carbohydrate diet. And I actually went to a museum exhibition about the origins of insulin and looked at some of the diaries of some of these kids. And in contrast to what you were told with insulin present, they were told to keep very careful diaries minimizing the amount of carbohydrates that they consumed and listing the protein and fat that they consumed. In other words, a very, very low, almost a keto diet for type 1 diabetes that enabled them to survive longer without any insulin on board.
Yeah. And, you know, today, unfortunately, the system is kind of stacked against getting the best outcomes for patients and what works, and more along the lines of what's profitable for the system. And so when the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry are funding a lot of the education of the dietitians and of the medical doctors, then yes, it becomes not so much about the evidence we have for what works the best, but more about what's going to continually make us a profit. And so that means, more processed food consumption, which is generally higher in carbohydrate, because that's the profitable food. You can make a living raising animal foods and lower carbohydrate foods, lots of them, but it's not necessarily profitable.
The margins aren't as good. Aren't as good. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just kind of stacked up against us that way. And that's the recommendations you get. And then, you become, let's say, a type 2 diabetic. And you require medications, and that's also profitable for the industry to require those medications. So the status quo kind of stays that way because the system is feeding itself. But meanwhile, the patients, the doctors are confused because they're getting the wrong information, and the patients are getting poor health outcomes.
Indeed. And so if you go to a conventional doctor these days, if you have type 1 diabetes, and you talk about a keto diet or a very low carb diet, they hear the word keto, and they remember from their medical school training that many patients with type 1 diabetes end up in the intensive care unit with ketosis in diabetic ketoacidosis. And so have you been warned that you might get in serious trouble if you induce ketosis when you have type 1 diabetes? I mean, it could be a train wreck, right? Or wrong?
Yeah, wrong, I'd say. Ketosis and ketoacidosis are two very different things.
Thank you.
Ketoacidosis.
Many doctors don't realize that. I think many doctors are under the impression.
They're not even aware you can get into ketosis without being ketoacidotic. Ketosis is basically a metabolic state where your body is burning primarily fatty acids and making ketones for fuel, which happens when you restrict carbohydrates. Whereas in type 1, ketoacidosis is basically the idea that, you're not making any insulin. So, glucose is not being able to, among other things, is not being able to get into the cell. So we have very high glucose levels and your body thinks it needs energy of some sort. So it starts making tons and tons of ketones because it thinks you're low carb because you have no glucose in your cells.
Right. And so it's like sugar everywhere, but not a drop to drink. It just is not utilizable by the cells.
Yeah. And so your body just goes into crazy keto mode, and that can be dangerous because then your ketones can get, well above like 10, 11, 12, 15, and it's just, that's a problem, whereas ketosis, we're healthily at around 3 to 5 or something like that, depending on the person and how well adapted you are. And that's a very healthy, metabolically healthy state. So
do you actually use a meter to monitor your keto status? Keto dieters, non-diabetics even, look at the degree to which they're achieving ketosis with low carb. Is that something that is practical for you, or do you just kind of wing it?
Yeah, I just kind of wing it now. I used to, you know, back when I first, you know, started the diet and everything, I would track things. But generally, like, you know, everybody says like 0.5 to 1.5 is mild ketosis and 1.5 to 3 is full ketosis. But I think that the more important thing is not necessarily what level of ketones you're at, but if you it's just testing for metabolic health. And the way I do that is if I am pretty well fat adapted and I'm burning fatty acids and I have, let's say, up to 100 grams of carbohydrates one night or my last meal of the day, and then I have this kind of shorter fast of 12 hours or so overnight, and I wake up and I test and there's ketones present, even if it's like 0.2 or 0.4 or something like that, that shows that my body was able to burn through the carbohydrates and immediately go back to making ketones, which indicates metabolic health. And that's what I want to see more than I want to see full-blown ketosis all the time or making a bunch of ketones. I want to see that metabolic flexibility.
And so have you been able to maintain a very optimal hemoglobin A1C through this method? Because it actually has been suggested that diabetics not strive with aggressive medical management for a very low hemoglobin A1C. They sort of back off. They say, look, you know, get it down to 7.5, you know, or 7 and change is good enough because it could be harmful. If you take too much in the way of insulin or too much in the way of the medications that dramatically lower blood sugar, you could become hypoglycemic, you could become lightheaded and pass out, or, you know, have an accident, faint, break your hip. This is the current recommendation. It's like, 7 and change is good enough.
Yeah, which to me is not good enough. Like, I don't understand why that would be the recommendation if we know that normal A1C, 4.5 to 5.5, that would be normal. So why are we not striving to achieve that for even someone who's type 1, especially type 2? But for me, it's always been like, oh yeah, 7 is good, you know, around there is good. But I
it's actually a C. It's a C plus if you get a 7, right?
Yeah. And, you know, Dr. Bernstein has always said that, you know, like that's an average blood sugar, I think like 120, 130, something like that, which is above normal. Although I do think that the real issue with higher blood sugar is fluctuations in high, or that's the more problematic issue, is that like drastic fluctuations is more damaging than, say, a higher blood sugar that's more stable. That's still not ideal, but it's better than the fluctuations. And so, I've been able to maintain, I mean, it's kind of evolved over the years, but especially since I've gone, low carb and, you know, I eat the same thing every day. I have the same routine. I give the insulin I give, I know how it's going to respond. I get A1Cs in the low 6s, high 5s, you know, which is,
wow, that is impressive. Really impressive for a type 1 diabetic. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a science I've come down with. So.
Good stuff. And of course, you know, okay. So, let's explain to the audience, insulin is your savior in this case, because your pancreas is incapable of making insulin, or makes trivial amounts at this point. And so it's a lifesaver. But on the other hand, insulin can be our enemy if we overproduce insulin, as in type 2 diabetes. It's called insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome. Insulin is not a lifesaver, it's an organ destroyer. And so it behooves us to try and keep our insulin as low as possible, either through natural management of our diet and exercise, sleep too is a factor and other things, but also as a diabetic to minimize our insulin requirements. Don't go, you know, in an effort to keep your blood sugar low, don't go overboard on insulin utilization, because it's like, you know, the Hindu god, the two-headed god that is the creator and destroyer.
Yeah. Well, you know, and, you know, as a kid, you know, they gave me that book that said, just count your carbohydrates and give as much insulin as you need for the carbohydrates. Eat as many carbohydrates as you want.
In other words, you ate to cover your insulin.
Yeah.
Eating was an effort to compensate for the blood sugar lowering effects of the insulin, rather than the opposite, which is that the insulin should cover your diet rather than.
Yeah, sometimes exactly. Mm-hmm. When in reality, like the exact opposite should be true, because we know that if you take a fasting insulin on somebody and it's elevated, that's a sign of insulin resistance, and that insulin resistance itself and elevations in insulin will cause damage. You know, there's pathology going there, like endothelial dysfunction is one of the main ones that happens with insulin signaling. So then the artery linings can't repair themselves very well. And so that elevation in insulin is an indication that you are resistant to insulin. And so your body sees that things are not receiving an insulin signal, and it starts to make more. Oh, we must need more insulin. So it creates more and more insulin to do that. And then we see that in the blood. And the problem, the real issue is that most physicians in Western medicine, they just look at your A1C and your blood sugar.
Yeah.
You know, and they're looking at that and they're waiting for that to become elevated. When in reality, you can have
elevated insulin well before your hemoglobin A1C. By the way, I just wrote an article to that effect for our newsletter on the value of hemoglobin A1C. And it's limited because you may have a seemingly pretty good hemoglobin A1C, but your body's working overtime to keep your blood sugar under control, producing too much insulin, which has deleterious effects. So what are some of the effects of excess insulin? We can enumerate fatty liver, inflammation, high blood pressure, elevated triglycerides, adverse lipid ratios, brain effects, right? You know, there's innumerable adverse effects.
Yeah, they're calling it type 3 diabetes now, diabetes in the brain, which is leading to, or it's contributing to all these neurodegenerative diseases. When you don't have insulin signaling, then a lot of things can go wrong in the body. And again, like we said, that doesn't have to be, you don't have to have blood sugar dysregulation before that happens. You could be leptin resistant and insulin resistant well before. Well before it affects blood sugar. And that's the issue, is that we should be screening for that and intervening then with low carbohydrate diets rather than, but see, the thing is that in medicine, they have one thing to treat diabetes, and that is insulin or diabetes medications, right? And so until you have something that you can treat as far as like a blood sugar, you can affect the blood sugar, then you can't really do anything. They don't know what to do. They're not educated on what to do. So if you take an insulin and it's high, the average medical practitioner is like, well, I don't know what to do with that. You know, I don't know how to make that go away. Whereas, you know, practitioners or people more in the know that, you know, this insulin resistance is being driven by poor circadian rhythm disruption, and poor metabolic health, which is driven by circadian rhythm disruption and processed food diets, the high carbohydrate processed food diets. Like, that's the fuel to the fire. So, yeah.
Indeed. All right. We've laid the groundwork for our next discussion in part two about why we need a metabolic revolution. And interesting things are happening at a national level. We've got a government coming in, which has as a slogan, MAHA, Make America Healthy Again. And in the spirit of that, and in a nonpartisan way, a group called metabolicrevolution.org has convened in Washington, which includes you, but other luminaries like Dr. Asim Malhotra, Robert Lustig, Nina Teichholz, Dr. Georgia Ead, Chris Palmer, Eric Westman, and many others who support the idea of turning the ship around, making America healthy again via a metabolic revolution. We'll find out more about what that's about and how our listeners can access the resources there. Our guest, Dr. Stephen Hussey, and I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for listening.